My name is Bryce Miller. I'm here with Major General Herbert Pitts. It is February 25th, 2005, and we're in Victoria, B.C. Major Pitts, I'd like you to start with a brief family background. When and where were you born?
I was born in 1929 in the interior of B.C. at Nelson. I was born and raised in the city and educated there until I left senior matric in 1948. To enroll in what was called the Canadian Services College program at that time, which was a divided group between both the Royal Military College in Kingston and another group in Royal Roads, referred to as the first 86 there. The group in Military College in Kingston were called the New 100. There were 186 in that first tri-service intake into the reestablished military colleges. Royal Roads up to that point had been run as a naval college principally. The year before we came in the fall of 1948, it had been for that only that one year before that time a combined Navy Air Force cadet intake. So we were sort of the bow wave, I guess, of the present military colleges system, which was reestablished in 1948 after the conclusion of the Second War. I spent 2 years in Royal Roads, enrolled principally as an Armored Corps cadet. I had chosen that as the branch of service and had spent 2 summers training as an Armored Corps cadet. Then for this third and fourth year moved to RMC in Kingston to finish the four-year course. I continued my training as an Armored Corps cadet. And on graduation in 1952, was commissioned into Lord Strathcona's Horse. I went on leave for 30 days plus travel time, which was also considered to be embarkation leave, because about 2 or 3 months prior to graduation in June of 52, we found that those of us who were going to take regular commissions, and there was no obligation to do so, but having been offered the chance to take a regular commission, many of the Army cadets did, because with it went the probable posting to Korea to join the Canadian Brigade there, which had been in the theater for a year as a brigade, about a little over a year, but as a Canadian presence about 18 months by that time. So the prospect was very enticing and challenging, and after 30 days leave plus travel time, I found myself en route to Korea in the middle of July 1952, wearing the uniform of Lord Strathcona's Horse. On arriving in the theater, I was shuffled off into a jeep and taken to brigade headquarters, which seemed a little strange and a little high in the Army hierarchy as far as I knew. And was told at that time by the then brigade major who met me, and I was advised that I would not be going to the squadron of the Strathconas in the theater at that time as a troop leader, as I had expected, but rather I would become a platoon commander with 1st Battalion Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry. For me, this was quite a leap from having been trained for 3 or 4 years as an Armored Corps officer to suddenly find myself faced with the prospect of commanding an infantry platoon in a unit which was in action. When I joined that unit, I went found out from the CO, Colonel Cameron, that I was expected. However, I was told that before he would assign me to a company, I should go away and change out of my Armored Corps kit that I was wearing and dress as a Patricia officer and come back, see him, and he would tell me which company I was going to. So I did. That was a hurried visit to the quartermaster to get outfitted in what I could get of Patricia paraphernalia at that time. Went back to Colonel Cameron, and he says, "You're going up to D Company." So I reported to Major Eisner, the company, which was in a reserve location at that time, and was told that my platoon would be number 11 platoon. So I went and I met number 11 platoon. This platoon sergeant was a fellow by the name of Fairhall. He gave me a quick briefing on the characters in the platoon, and then I joined them around a campfire, because we were in a reserve position, and got to to get the feeling of the people who were there, or who were the characters, and recognized a few of them by name. And then I went to bed feeling, well, perhaps I'd landed, and this is where I was going to belong for the next little while. Only to wake up the following morning and be told by Major Eisner that I was not going to be staying with the platoon for a little while, because my place had to be taken by an officer who had to get his, quote, ticket punched, unquote, and who had not had a platoon in the line, and he should have before rotation took place. Rotation back to Canada for 1st Battalion was to take place in about 4 months' time, 4 months' time. And this officer was to get in there and get his time in the line in command of platoon. My job, I was told, would be to go with as an advance party for the company to join the 1st Battalion of the Norfolks in the British Brigade and do a reconnaissance, report on what the routines they were following were, what the gaps in the wire were, what trails into the positions would apply. All of this was relatively new to me because it's not the kind of thing that my training had stressed in any great detail. However, I went and joined the 1st Battalion of the Norfolk. I forget which rifle company it was, but it was the rifle company into whose position we would move in about 10 days' time. I found that to be one of the most instructive periods of my life, in that there was an operating rifle company. I was placed in the company command post as an observer and treated very well. And I had an opportunity to look and see what other people were doing, how they did it, without the responsibilities for carrying any of it out. I was a witness, so to speak, and what I was seeing was my upcoming, the next few months, formulating in my mind as to how platoons behaved, what the tasks were, when the stand-to periods were, what the fire tasks were, where the minefields were, where the gaps were, where the patrol routes were, where the standing patrols were. And all of this was fascinating, I must say, to somebody just coming into the theater, but a great knowledge experience. And I'm very thankful for that, despite the fact I didn't want to leave the platoon, which I'd only spent 24 hours with. As it turned out, the platoon came into the line about 5 or 6 days later. There was about a week's period in there when I was with the Norfolks, and they came into the line. I saw them in, along with a couple of other guides which had been sent up, and then I went back to the A echelon, for a week. That week was the week that this replacement officer that replaced me was to get his introduction into platoon commanding in the line. And about a week later, I came back from the echelon into my platoon and began to familiarize myself all over again. But I had known the routine and the layout that they would be in, and it was not a surprise encounter from my point of view. I regretted I hadn't been with them in the intervening roughly 2 week period from when I first came in until I went into the line, because I wanted to get to know them a little bit better than it turned out I did. In any event, that position was the left forward company of 1st Battalion, and it was adjacent to and overlooked by Hill 355, which was a position occupied by 1st Battalion, the Royal Canadian Regiment. The period I'm talking about now is roughly mid-August, and things went along through August and September and through half of October in a way which gave all of us a lot of time spent in the valley. That was sort of a common term for getting out on patrols or outposts or ambushes. And I found out when I reported first to that position in the company's location, I was one of five officers in the company. There were three platoon commanders, which was as it should be. There was a company 2IC, and there was a major commanding the company, Major Eisner. As that period from mid-August to mid-October progressed, we found that people were posted out, people were picking up other appointments, And at the end of that period, roughly second week in October, there were only two officers left in the company. There was a Captain Scott Campbell, who was commanding the company in the rank of captain, and I was the only officer platoon commander. The other two platoons were commanded by, one by Sergeant Richardson, and I forget who the third platoon commander was. It seems to me he was either a senior corporal or a junior sergeant. In any event, we were strapped not only for command personnel in there. Our strength had started to wither away because we were due for rotation home, those of us who had spent a whole year there. And reinforcements were not forthcoming because the 3rd Battalion, which was to replace us, was coming over fully staffed, expecting to get a few of us to join them, which would bring them right up to full strength. And the 1st Battalion was doing without reinforcements virtually for the last 2 or 3 months they were there. So our platoons were very small, our command structure was very lean. And during this period, we were subjected to a fair amount of harassing fire. As it turned out, the Chinese were preparing for an attack on this hill, 355, which was on our immediate left. We were on the boundary between the two battalions. And 355 was an extremely important feature for the Commonwealth Division. It overlooked the entire rear area of the Commonwealth Division layout behind the front line, including views over the Imjin River, which was the area that really divided friend from foe. And in order to be in the most advantageous to protect the Imjin River, hills like 355 and the Hook, which were on either end of the Commonwealth Division's line, had to be held because they prevented the Chinese overlooking the Imjin and further south. So it was a critical area that was being defended by the brigade at that time and by the division. All of its brigades were forward across the Imjin River in dominating ground, which had been secured in the summer of 1951-2 in that period. Summer 51, fall of 52. So holding those features, particularly 355 and the Hook, were extremely important. The RCR was on the Hook, on the 355 rather, in October of 1952 when the Chinese decided to take a run at it. Now the period leading up to that attack on the 23rd, 24th October in 1952 was in fact one of fairly intense artillery preparation by the Chinese. And being the company adjacent to that hill, we took an awful lot of registration ammunition and hazard fire from the Chinese, harassing fire, in order, I guess, to somehow conceal the actual objective from sort of analysis or from our point of view. That didn't work. Everybody knew that it was 355 that they were going to be after, if in fact they were serious about mounting an attack. It was an extremely difficult hill for them to attack. It was also kind of difficult to defend because it was a large feature. Ideally, the terrain that was given to one major unit, like 1st Battalion and the RCR, and they were supplemented by some of their echelon people, so they had to provide, I think they set up an additional company position in there to give them both length and depth. The Chinese did eventually mount that attack in late October, and my involvement with it is something that I'll always remember, because being in D Company of 1st PPCLI, we had rotated into a reserve position about 10 days before the RCR was attacked. And we were still at this low strength with just the two officers. And when the RCR were hit, and it was unmistakably a major event, a major attack, we were told by our CO to go over and do a recce, because our company was going to be placed under command of one RCR if they needed help in mounting a counterattack. So Scott Campbell, the captain, and myself, for some reason I accompanied him, and I can't really tell you why, he asked that I come along. And the two of us went over to the RCR battalion command post and were briefed by their acting CO, Colonel Frank Klenovic, and their battle adjutant, Major Don Holmes. The actual CO, Peter Bingham, had taken a well-deserved break and for his R&R, and he was out of the theater when that attack took place. So his battle was fought by his two IC, Klenovic, and his battle adjutant, Don Holmes. In any event, our job, as it turned out to be after getting a briefing from those two officers, was that we would relieve one of their companies, their right forward company, the one that overlooked our position when we were left forward of the Patricia layout. And we would probably be used not in a counterattack unless something serious developed, but rather to relieve them so that their C company could come off the hill down into a position to mount a counterattack, and they would do their own counterattack and cleanup. And I can't blame them. I think if there had been a similar situation facing us, we would probably have used our own people to do the counterattack and use whatever we held help we were given to secure the area, so it was there was no threat going to be posed from something unforeseen. So in the course of that battle-ridden night, early in the morning, before daylight, we made our way, that is the whole of Delta Company, or D Company, one PPCLI, made its way up to the top of 355, relieved their C Company, who was withdrawn to prepare a counterattack. We, for a period of 10 days, stayed in that position and became P Company, or Patricia Company, of 1RCR. And it was a period, again, of learning from my point of view as to how the infantry worked, how counterattacks were planned, what possible roles we could get involved in, taking over patrol tasks from another unit, another regiment. There were differences in command and procedures, but again, I was like a sponge at that time. I was soaking up everything that could come out of an experience like that. So the 10 days spent with the RCR as Peter Company, I don't know if it's even recorded in their battle diary or history. I suspect it's in the diary, but I don't know if it's in the history. Was for me kind of a privilege in a way, in that I got up on a feature that has been talked about, has been fought over, has been defended and attacked, and I appreciated that period in there as one of again learning. When the changeover between the battalions of the Patricias took place in very early November of 1952. Our company, D Company, was pulled down off the hill and taken out from under command of 1RCR and rejoined the Patricias. We rejoined them in rather a shabby way. I don't mean the Patricias' treatment of us was shabby, but we had been in the line from roughly the middle of August to the middle of November was approaching, and we had very little in the way of repairs to equipment, replacements of equipment. We came down off that hill some people would say in shithouse order, and I guess probably that's pretty close to it. Our pants were torn in some cases, they were dirty, they were soiled, they were muddy, small pieces of things were missing. We had been in sort of constant contact, albeit not all close, but we had not had an opportunity to do some of the things that one would normally expect. We did get breaks into the mobile laundry and bath unit every couple of weeks or so, and could get replacements for minor pieces of uniform, but kit replacements and those things were pretty few and far between, and you lost various small bits of people of kit over a period of time as people went out into the valleys, were on patrols, were quickly leaving various positions, shot off them or scared off them. It's one of those things that that you don't appreciate how significant it is till you're suddenly pulled out, and as a group of about 70 of us, that's all there was in the company, we sort of lined up and looked at ourselves and said, holy Moses, where has this army been? This is Popsky reappearing. We were dressed quite differently, and of course the problem was we had to go and parade the next day for the change of command parade or the changeover parade between the two battalions. And our new company commander, whose name was Staff Shawcross, into which this group of D Company persons from the 1st Battalion was to fit, I don't think did any good for the appearance of his company. And I heard that Herb Wood, who was the commander of the 3rd Battalion, was not very happy with Staff Shawcross in his D Company because they didn't look so hot. And that's understandable, but it certainly wasn't Shawcross's fault, and I'd like to think it wasn't our fault either. Both Scott Campbell, the company commander, and myself were two officers that were then meshed with three officers from the 3rd Battalion. Staff Shawcross was the company commander. Scott Campbell remained as the 2IC, and the other two platoon commanders beside myself were a fellow by the name of Russ Campbell, who was later a school teacher in Saskatchewan, and Peter Worthington was the other platoon commander, who is well known as a journalist and a newspaper editor, a publisher at one time. His father had been a patricia prior to the outbreak of the Second War, and Peter was sort of following along in family sequence, I guess. He'd been in the Navy briefly, I believe, at the end of the Second War, but was so young that he hardly got in, and the war was over. So he joined the Army when recruiting for Korea was being done, and came to D Company of 3rd Battalion of the Patricias. I got to know Peter quite well. Russ, unfortunately, I think on return, sort of went to a small area in Saskatchewan, and I think is now dead. I suspect both Shawcross and Campbell may be, so that of the five officers there at that time, there's only two alive that I'm aware of. My platoon sergeant was new. He came with the 3rd Battalion group, and a fellow by the name of Peter Mann, who I got to know extremely well and who I thought a lot of. Peter was much older than the rest of us, it appeared. He was a Second World War veteran who had re-enlisted for the Korean War. He brought with it a certain degree of maturity. But the new platoon that now grew out of the marrying of the two companies from 1st and 3rd Battalion was a full-strength platoon, and it was really great to have 33 or 34 or 35 people in a platoon as opposed to 20, which is roughly what we had when 1st Battalion was winding down. That period, when we first joined them in early November, was spent in rehearsing counterattacks for a feature known as the hook, which was on the left extremity, that is the western extremity of the Commonwealth Division. The 355 was on one, as I said, and this one was on the other. But this one was different than 355 in that it was much closer to the enemy. There were bends in the lines there that brought OPs and patrol positions and trenches much closer together. That too was regarded as one of the critical features in the Commonwealth line, and had to be held at all costs. So 3rd Battalion's first job was to do a counterattack rehearsal, recce, planning, to help the British battalion that was occupying it, the Imperial Black Watch at that time, in the event of a Chinese attack. Well, wouldn't you know it, there's a new battalion in the theater, us, preparing for a counterattack, and I'll be damned if about 10 days later there wasn't a requirement to mount a counterattack. And so the attack was planned. Each of us had, as far as I can recall, each company had a company position that we rehearsed to recapture, to secure in the event that it was needed. The company that we rehearsed for was not one of the company positions that was taken by the Chinese. They took a position which was sort of front and center on the top and overlapped two of their companies. And two of the companies of 3rd Battalion were tasked to counterattack those two areas, and both our, the other two rifle companies were held in reserve. And that was what my job was during the restoration of the Hook position. Now, the Hook position had been blown apart by the Chinese. They mounted a savage artillery preparation program, and a lot of the trenches were blown in and wire destroyed. And it was a position that had to be rebuilt because it probably couldn't be held the way it was. Herb Wood, who was the commanding officer of the 3rd Battalion, was tasked, I guess, to relieve the Black Watch in due course, and his job was to prepare that position for occupation by his battalion so it could be held. They sent out a call around 3rd Battalion for volunteers to participate in what was called locally a blitzkrieg wiring crew. I heard the expression used in a company, and I didn't pay too much attention to it until I got a call for the company commander to go and see the CO. So I went to see the CO, and he told me that I had been picked among a host of applicants to be the officer that would train this blitzkrieg wiring crew. And I would take myself and 35 men down to an engineer echelon while the Patricias were in reserve, and prepare under engineer instruction teams to go and relay the wire in front of the Hook. We were given about 4 days to do the training, so I went down on my own. I knew a couple of people in my platoon that had volunteered, but I didn't pay an awful lot of attention to that because I didn't know whether they would get picked. And sure enough, when I got down there, there were these two characters sort of smiling and chuckling and said, "Aha, you know, we figured you might be down here." Well, they figured something I didn't figure. However, they were a group of 35 people from across the battalion. Every company was represented. They were all volunteers, and they all volunteered for this gig called the Blitzkrieg Wiring Crew. Well, as it turned out, we worked like devils for the next 3 or 4 days, mastering drills of laying triple concertina wire in three belts, one by each of three teams, under engineer instruction, and we achieved, I think, some fairly remarkable timings. We could lay 100 triple concertina yards, three belts, in 10 minutes at night. Now, the usual standard is about that in daytime, but we had a competition. It was supposedly a friendly competition. And that was the honor of laying the belt closest to the enemy would go to the team with the best time. We figured maybe they had to get out of there more quickly. However, the three teams would be lined up, and we would enter into competition once we got the drills down. And there was no dispute that one of the teams that went in under 10 minutes at night that could do this was a team led by Corporal Moon Mullen. Corporal Mullins was a 20-year-old, gung-ho young guy, full of energy, full of personality, great team leader, and he had his team going like skunk. Well, the other two were not far behind, but Mullins, as it turned out, got the honor of laying the belt closest to the enemy when and if we went to do it. Well, Colonel Wood was as good as his promise, and he got us up after 4 days and briefed me on where he wanted the wire laid. Brought out an old map and said, this is where I want you to put the wire. The CO of the Black Watch, who still has command of the position, agrees that's where it should go. And I said, well, sir, that looks to me like an old minefield. And he said, oh, yeah, but it's old. That's the key point. It's been run over, shot over, fought over. There's probably no mines there. None that are active in any event. And I said, well, can we lay it anywhere else? And he said, no, that's where I want the wire. And I said, okay, we'll go do it. And I was told how much to lay, and I'll mention that in a minute. And we figured out the stores that we needed to lay that wire, got the message off to the echelon to pick up the wire, get it from divisional stores or wherever you get it, and get it up to the behind the Black Watch company that night. So I went out and briefed the three teams, and we were still in our own battalion area. Went back and briefed the three teams, and I gave them some idea of what we were going to be doing. And I said, there's a certain risk involved here. I said, there is an old minefield, and the CO considers that if there are any mines there, they will be inert or non-operable. And he's probably right. And I said, we're going to go up and do this job because it's critical to the battalion's security in about a day or two when they're going to go in and take over the position from the British. So there were no hesitations, and we went through another little bit of a rehearsal, certified laid down which was going to be the team that would be laying close to the laying wire closest to the enemy, and that was Mullins. And the other two teams would participate in the second and the third belt. We brought up enough stores for 1,800 yards in total of wire that night. 600 yards in each of three belts. And we had a Korean service company that was provided to us in order to carry those stores to our working location. We would take down the first load when we went, and they would keep us resupplied with stuff so we could get those 600 yards in three belts laid. I took the three team leaders down to do a reconnaissance, and we picked an area that was a datum point or a start point for us, and it was a little tree stump which was there. And I said to Corporal Mullins, this is where you start, right here at this tree stump, and you go that way 600 yards, and the others will go behind you by about 5 or 6 yard gaps. So everybody had their start point picked out, and we turned around, went back, and got the teams, started down. And at this point, I left the lead of the group because something had happened behind. I could hear some mumbling or some slipping and falling. So I turned around and said to Corporal Mullins, you go ahead. You know where the datum point is. And he said, yep, there's our footprints. And I said, yes, okay, because there had been a little bit of snow. So he stepped out and went another maybe 4 or 5 paces, and there was a hell of an explosion. I had just turned my back and started back the line to see what was happening back there. And he had stepped on a mine, and it was a bouncing mine, a bouncing Betty, which exploded at about his shoulder level and killed him instantly. The man behind him, a private Batch, was also wounded. He was down on the ground. And by the time I took 2 or 3 steps to get to him, he was obviously not going to survive. I put my hand behind his shoulder and head and asked him where he was hit, and all he could do was sort of choke. So I put my hand inside his jacket, and it was just soaking wet. As far as I could see, he was hit only by one piece of shrapnel, and it went right through his heart. So we had two almost instantaneous deaths from one of the team leaders. And of course, this is the first time that the group had been anywhere over in front of our own lines. And they were all hugging the ground at this point, which was part of the drill. If something happened, you go to ground, and they had their weapons ready. And I heard a hell of a commotion behind me, and what it was the Korean carriers dropping their stores and taking off back over the hill. Well, I was in contact on the British net and asked them to send down stretcher parties to pick up our two casualties. And I then went to the team and I said, we've got to get out of here and move forward. I asked the platoon sergeant to stay with the two bodies, and we moved our teams forward. I then took over the leadership of number one team, which was Corporal Mullen's team. And we started to get ready to lay the wire. And I said, look, I intend to do this job and to get it done to the other two team leaders. I said, I'd understand if there was a reluctance on anybody's part. But I said, if we're going to back off this time, I said, this is the first operation that the 3rd Battalion has really carried out other than the counterattack. And it's the first time that we've come forward of the line. And I want to finish it. So they went back and told their people, and they all came forward. They all fell in their spots, picked up their kit, came to the datum points and started out. And we laid the 600 belts, three of them, that night. The real problem was getting the Service Corps carriers to keep us supplied. I eventually got the platoon sergeant, to go back and get the Korean officer and bring him forward. Was running that company, and I said, unless you get charge of those people and you get them back here and get them carrying our supplies so we can finish this job, I'm going to turn you in. And I guess it's a matter of face, but he seemed surprised that anybody would talk to him that way, and I had my hand on my pistol, but I obviously wasn't going to shoot him. However, he pulled his pistol, and I wasn't sure what he was going to do to me. In fact, he turned on his heels and went back to the company, and I don't know what he said to his carriers, but they appeared again with the stores, brought it down very gingerly, and were just very happy to get back up to the hill to get another load without anything happening at the sort of our assembly area. I suspect he threatened to shoot them, which was not uncommon in the Korean Army. For an officer to take that sort of discipline step in order to get his orders followed. All I could do was threaten him with loss of face, and that seemed to be enough under this particular circumstance. I guess what I wanted to say about this is that two nights later, that same crew came with me to do 600 yards of wire in the other direction, so that the battalion was then at least behind three belts 1,200 yards long of wire, which was replacing I don't know how much stuff that was blown out of there in the attack. It was a feat of engineering which had not been attempted before. I didn't think an awful lot about it. I was glad it was over, quite frankly, and that the team had performed as they had. I've got the utmost admiration for those young men, and I've got the utmost respect for Mullen, Corporal Mullen, and Private Batch. They are people that I constantly remember when I think about what soldiering is, how it's done, what they sacrificed in order to get things done. They helped train a team, were critical members of it, and their job got done. So I guess in their memory, I'm as happy as for any other reason that those things were done in the way that they would have wanted them done. Now that was an important feature that was secured. We then occupied it for a period of about a month from roughly mid-November to just after Christmas time, so I guess it was about 6 weeks. We went in and relieved the Black Watch. The Black Watch came in subsequently and relieved us. The RCR came in subsequently and relieved us between Christmas and New Year's. We spent Christmas in that position, receiving messages from the Chinese, who left signs up in front of us saying, Merry Christmas, your darling misses you. What would your mummy say if she knew you were fighting in Korea and that you were being attacked by the Chinese? There was propaganda material that was left out there. And of course, our aim it seemed, was to go out and tear it all down and come back and laugh about it. But in fact, it's kind of interesting to imagine what could have happened if it had been booby-trapped, or if in fact it was placed in an artillery target. We did the things, I guess, that young men wanted to do to show that they were unafraid, but in fact there was risk attached. From my point of view, the period was interesting. It was again a vital period in the layout and the sequence of events which was transpiring at that time. I was given a break from the line after that. I was sent down to the junior NCO school in Wee John Boo just after New Year's to be a Patricia platoon instructor at the Commonwealth school. There were people from all of the Commonwealth nations there organized into four platoons. Three of them were English-speaking platoons. The fourth one was a French-speaking platoon because of the Vandu involvement in the brigade. That was a learning experience for me as well. Many of the drills and things that I thought I knew were refined there by having to prepare lesson plans to impart that knowledge to young NCOs who were there as training as either lance corporals or corporals to go back and take section commander positions in their units. A very good time from my point of view, a very good break from the line. It began to be kind of stressful, and this was my break, and it lasted about 2.5 months. We put two courses through, and then I went back to the battalion in early April, late March, early April. The whole of the Commonwealth Division had been out of the line while I had been at the school and was just going back into the line when I rejoined the battalion. And I rejoined the battalion as the base plate officer for the mortar platoon, which to me was a strange thing because I had had no connection with support weapons at all because of my own background in the Armored Corps and my platoon commander experience up to that point. The nice thing was getting to know something else about how the infantry ran its support weapons, and to be given a job as the base plate officer on the mortar line was probably the best job that you could get in a battalion. I replaced, or displaced, he would tell you, a famous old battalion character by the name of Barney Barnett, who in fact enjoyed life on the base plate and on the mortar line with his crew, but had to go and relinquish it to me. And went up to battalion headquarters as one of the duty officers in the CO's presence, so to speak. But that was Barney's tough luck. He'd had a run at it, and I was now his 2IC down on the mortar line. That's a period that, to me, was fascinating in lots of ways. We developed drills. Our mortar line consisted of two 4.2 rifled American mortars, our own six 81-millimeter mortar. And we brigaded or brought in from rifle companies six of their 60-millimeter mortars. So on that mortar line, we had a total of 14 mortars of various calibers. The weapon of choice for dealing with intrusions or supporting patrols was, of course, our own 81-millimeter mortars. The 4.2s were mortars which were secured from American sources, but they were extremely accurate, but very heavy and very difficult to keep in operation. We did not have crews to man them. We only were crewed for our own 81-millimeter mortars, and the company mortar crews came with their own 60s. So we couldn't man those two 4.2s, and we used them only for specialist jobs like bunker busting or OP busting, and they were accurate enough in order to do that. The one really sort of significant event that I can recall, among other sort of emergency fire tasks which came in from patrols and OPs, was the night that the RCR were hit again on our left. Three RCR had just come into the line at that point, and in early May the 2nd, 3rd, I think, they were hit on Hill 187 by a Chinese attack. And that's where most of the Canadian POWs that were taken at one time probably were taken that night. And we fired in support of them throughout that night. We fired something over 4,500 rounds of mortar ammunition, and when the dawn came up the next day, our mortar line looked like a garbage dump. We'd had two and a half ton truck loads of mortar ammunition brought in during the night. It was all sort of thrown into the mortar pits and used, and the boxes and casings and wrappings and padding was all sort of thrown out, and it really did look like a garbage dump by the time light came up in the morning. But it had been a very successful shooting night from our point of view, despite the fact that we were harassed, or there was counter battery fire directed at our base plate. We had been in an excellent position, and were in an excellent position, down low in a bowl, and the harassing fire that came in caught the ridges behind us mostly. I would think some of the rifle companies were not too pleased about it, but I don't think it really bothered them greatly, but our position protected us, and it did cause concern in that we knew what they were going after, and that was us. They just didn't have the weapon to get us. So we maintained our fire missions all night. When I look back on that period, I've been asked whether there was ever any friendly fire sort of incidents in my time. One of them that occurred that night was, not that night, in that position, was a rather routine fire call came in to us. A task was referred to us by one of our mobile fire controllers, and I chose a 4.2 weapon to deal with it because it was a suspected OP on the other side of the valley. And I calculated the charge, the range, the deflection, all the rest of it, and passed it out to the mortars. And when the crew fired, I told the mortar fire controller, I said, shot, and he was then listening in. And in the flight time that should have occurred,